Well, we're halfway through the halfway point of the week show. Blaine and Mickey, happy hump day to everybody. Titans are on the field practicing. It's like the hottest day in 12 years or whatever it is. It's like the county fair back where I came from, Blaine. So once a year, let me tell you what happened. Harrisburg, Arkansas, a fair rolled into town. You ever been to a county fair?
I went every year growing up in the Indiana State Fairgrounds. Absolutely did. Okay. You know, they got a lot of, I mean, I remember my first job was corn to tasseling.
Okay.
You just forgot.
Okay. Forget about the state fair. This is the county fair. Like, you can throw a rock over the whole thing. You can stand on one side and throw a rock. It looked like a military prison camp. They had chain link fences and cinder block buildings. It was this ugly place, but magic happened there. Fair would show up. You get all hopped up on caramel apples and the tilt-a-whirl and, you know, a hamburger cooked by old ladies in the extension booth, which I'm, you know, same age as those ladies now, so they're very young. I realized that as I got older. And like a bowl of white beans, and then people would grow like the biggest pumpkin and the biggest ear of corn. But here's one thing you could count on. It was going to rain that week. You could be in a two-month drought, but when the county fair rolled into town, you could bet your butt it was going to rain. Well, Titans hit the field. What happens? Excruciating heat comes back right on cue. So, you know, all those guys, well, they get to battle each other for roster spots, but they also got to battle that heat right from the jump today.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what JG was referring to. Like, yeah, there were a lot of energy in Tibba halfway through practice. Yeah. They got to start moving a little slower. Just look for perception, even on the jogs, they were a little slower.
Yes.
So, yeah, but, you know, that actually come into play as the season goes on in the beginning of the season, not necessarily the preseason. It could become an advantage, you know, with the humidity and the heat this high. And it was been predicted all week that this was going to be, you know, hot the remainder of this week. So, yeah, they're getting a full dose of, you know, some real heat and humidity. So, hopefully it'll play a part down the road and help them out at the beginning of the season.
So, John Robinson made some noise. He got up and spoke literally before practice started, kind of called an impromptu thing, got everybody over and said the Titans are at 90% vaccination rate. He said guys are at different sort of levels. Some are not vaccinated. Some are one shot but not two shots. Some have had both the shots, but then you're not fully vaccinated for like 14 more days. I guess it's like soup. It has to sit. Yeah, it's better like the next day or chili. So same for the vaccine, although it's 2 weeks, I guess, for it to cure. So he said, guys are in different places. Well, then the next thing that happened was they went out for individual, and two of the guys that got named that had a mask on, because he said some guys are going to have to wear masks because of where they are in the process, Ryan Tannehill, Christian Fulton. And so some people, again, the vaccine, it's your personal business, what you want to do or not do, but it is business. It is our business, and we have to talk about what's going on with NFL guys who have or haven't had it because it could affect the team. And literally, Lamar Jackson had COVID last year, missed a game. He had a positive test today. So Lamar Jackson, and they're trying to figure out what's going on because he had tested negative until today. You got an NFL quarterback who's already tested positive, whose team really needs him. So Ryan Tannehill, you heard part of the update with Lucas Panzeca to start the hour. Ryan Tannehill essentially said, yes, I'm partially way through the process. I wasn't going to do it, but the NFL has essentially forced our hand as players. And he outlined all the things that you can't do if you're not fully vaccinated. You know, you can't eat with your teammates. You can't meet with them a certain way. You can't be with them. And he talked about chemistry and team building. But you brought this up when all of it happened. They're going to make life as hard as they can on the people who don't get vaccinated. And here's the Titans quarterback essentially backing up everything you said this offseason. Like, I had to do it.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. I wouldn't have gotten the vaccine if without the protocols that they're enforcing on us. I think it's a personal decision for everyone. Everyone has to make the best decision for them and their families. That's kind of our mindset in this building. But they're trying to force your hand, and they ultimately have forced a lot of hands by the protocols, which is, you know, everyone has their own opinions on. So it is what it is. You know, I love this game. I love this team. I want to be able to compete and do the things that, you know, I think are important to build chemistry and win football games. So ultimately that forced my hand and to get in the vaccine.
Ryan, other than the protocols, any conversations in the midst of making that decision that helped ease your mind, medical professionals, people that were brought into the team, what were the conversations like as you went through that process?
Yeah, there were a ton of conversations. You know, the team brought people in to talk to us, doctors to talk to us. There was a lot of conversations in the spring. I think our numbers were obviously lower in the spring with who was vaccinated. You know, had a ton of conversations in the spring, strong opinions about it as there are everywhere. And ultimately, I think, like you said, we almost 90% or close to 90% of the guys are either vaccinated or in process. So you kind of see what the trend is. And like I said, our hand was kind of forced if you didn't want to, you know, abide by all the hefty protocols.
I guess was your mind.
So there you go. That was Ryan Tannehill, Blaine. And again, he backed up all the things that you were saying about players in the league now. Like, at some point, you may just have to go do it because you can't go here, you can't go there, you can't be around this guy, you got to stay 6 feet away from that guy. And this seems to alleviate all that, a lot of that, when you just go and get vaccinated.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think he was referencing a lot of the things he's saying you're kind of forced to. It starts right in the facility. And I think then that brings about questions with the players who are vaccinated, like, hey, man, you know, you're the leader of our team, man. You're not going to get vaccinated? When you go get vaccinated? Brings about question, doubt. And then he's like, I have to, because I need to be around my teammates if I want to lead. And when I'm the quarterback, I want to have communication with them. It's nothing like it. So, and then you want to continue to build that chemistry. So, yeah, I knew it was going to be that way once they came out with the rules. And I thought it was going to make, you know, their whole strategy, the league towards the players, has always been pit the players versus each other. And I thought that's what they were actually doing here, to force conversation, to force you then to abide by the rules with the vaccination. And do you want to win? And guess what? If I was in that case and I didn't want to get vaccinated, guess what? I would want to win more than anything else, because ultimately this is a great team. It's built with the, you know, capabilities of making a run to the Super Bowl. So why would you want to hurt that process? And you will be forced, at least on the Titans, to get the shot regardless. If not, life will be miserable for you. Now, the position, maybe not so much, but the quarterback absolutely got to get it.
Yeah. You brought this up, and we're up against the break. We're going to have we're taking a tour around the SEC. We're going to have Ole Miss reporter Nick Suss on. By the way, he was the guy who called Deion Sanders Deion instead of Coach.
Ooh, I can't wait till you ask him that.
So he dealt with that. But this is something we need to get into this week. And certainly people could weigh in on Twitter at Blaine and Mickey. It is a subject that you've been bringing up now for about 3 months.
What's that?
So if this is, and I know you think this could be the best offense in team history, right?
Yeah.
You think this could be the best offense in team history. Yeah. And then you spent millions to fix the defense. Like, literally, you did it like it was the old house with 70s and 60s, and you knocked out the walls and replaced it. You did everything. You did a complete remodel on the defense. Then you have two dudes as the kicker who've never kicked. I mean, that would be like, I bought the nicest car. I spent it. I fixed it up. I did everything I could. But then I forgot to put tires on, you know, one side. I mean, are you comfortable with the kicking situation, seeing as how much money they've spent on everything else? I know you can't spend a ton on everything, but that's something we got to get into this week, because that made me think about it again. You think this could be the best offense they've ever had. They've completely remodeled the defense. The two kickers are just guys who've never kicked.
They didn't miss a kick today. We're going to keep it sharp. Yeah, they both went, I don't know, 4 for 4, 4 for 5. I don't know, 5 for 5. I don't know. They didn't miss a kick, though, as I understand it. You know, I'm monitored behind closed doors.
Like, I know.
Everywhere. I want to know what the kicker's doing. And people don't really care about the kicker until he misses a field goal to win the game, you know, or to solidify a game. So they're doing well at practice, but we still won't know until that game one kick that you got to make. And it may not even be in game one. I mean, remember, they went for a while. The guy didn't even kick them but extra points, the kicker they signed. So,
yeah,
hey, man, they're going to ride it. And they must believe and you know, and think these guys can, you know, these guys can handle it. So we're going to trust in them until we don't. That's it, until they prove us wrong. Man, jeez.
I'm a little bit nervous because they spent a lot of money
yeah
on everywhere else. And I know games sometimes come down to kickers, and the kickers are Blake Hobel and Tucker McCann. So if you combine them into one guy, like a power couple, I guess if Blake and Tucker, they'd be Blucker. So somehow your man Blucker is going to have to figure this deal out. I mean, you spent all
we
got
to go to break right there on that. Blucker is our kicker. Blucker.
Well, people might be saying things that rhyme with Blucker if this thing doesn't go well. All right, Nick Suss joins us next. He's the Ole Miss beat writer. Let's talk some college football. We got lots to discuss. Blaine and Mickey. Let's
Bluckers.
Just go to commercial, please, Lucas. Blaine and Mickey, 104.5 The Zone. Thanks for hanging out with us. Happy hump day to you. Titans have reported they're practicing. There's lots going on in college football as well. And we've been doing a tour of the SEC with writers for different teams. Now, this guy's interesting, Nick Suss, and Nick joins us now at Nick Suss from the Clarion Ledger. We had him on the first time because he was covering Mississippi State in the College World Series, and he's the Ole Miss beat writer. But you turned out to be a good luck for a charm for those guys. Nick, they won the whole darn thing, and none of those guys will ever have to buy, like, a beer or a steak again in the state of Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, I'd venture to say that of the 1,000 people who made that happen, I might have been like 994th on the list, so I don't deserve too much credit. But nonetheless, it was a fun trip. I love going to Omaha every time I get the opportunity to, and that's the second team I've been able to cover there. Both teams have made it all the way to the last day. It's a lot of fun. If you guys ever have the opportunity, listening or just people I'm talking to right now, head out to Omaha. It's a great time.
All right, I want to start with this. I'm going to tie this to Tennessee. I used to work in local TV, and they would say localize every story. I think the blueprint for Josh Heupel is to do something similar to what Lane Kiffin did last year. And I looked. Ole Miss was first in total offense, and they were last in total defense. And I don't know if Tennessee will be first or last in either one of those categories, but it was almost like this shell game where it's like you were so busy watching the offense, you didn't realize how bad they were on defense sometimes, because they're going to get the ball right back and they'll do something great again. I think if Heupel could do the thing, just like Kiffin, win half his games, have a dynamic offense, it could buy some time for everything along the way, especially the defense. How right or wrong do you think that is?
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right to a point that maybe an unknown connection for some people in Tennessee. Ole Miss's offensive coordinator is Jeff Lebby, who the previous year before Kiffin hired him away was the offensive coordinator under Heupel at UCF. So there is some connection to style, to philosophy, to they hire similar type of people. And I think that if you are going to succeed in the SEC, there have pretty much been two blueprints in the last 15 years. One has been higher offense, and the other has been Kirby Smart. Other than that, nobody has figured out a way to win pretty consistently in the SEC. I can't think of, I guess Mark Stoops, you could give him some credit for consistently being a 7-9 win team at Kentucky. But if you're talking about the teams that truly have aced their way to the top of the league, whether it was 2019 LSU or the Malzahn Auburn teams or Urban's Florida teams or even Dan Mullen's Florida teams, Dan Mullen's teams at State, Hugh Freeze's teams at Ole Miss, those have been offensive teams, and that's kind of the blueprint that Ole Miss is attacking right now. They're trying to get better defensively, but I think they're always going to be billed as an offensive team, and that's kind of what Tennessee is resetting towards after 3 years with Jeremy Pruitt where things didn't work out the way that they had been intended. It's pretty clear they are now trying to say, well, if we score 40, we're probably going to win at least half of our games.
Yeah, that Pruitt offense, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh, that was tough to watch. Nick Suss joins us, Ole Miss beat writer Clarion Ledger, talking about the Rebels.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I guess we could ask both Mississippi State, too, as well. But what have you learned about Kiffin and Leach, I guess, that a lot of people don't know until you start covering them, whether it's on the field, you know, off the field, whatever it may be? Because it's pure entertainment from outside looking in. So give us the inside bird's eye view of what actually really what they're like.
Yeah, I probably sound like a broken record saying this if anyone's heard me do radio on this station or anywhere else before, but Kiffin is so much more of a remarkably tame and boring person on a day-to-day basis than everybody kind of gets from his eccentricity on Twitter and just the one or two press conference clips they've seen where he kind of goes out there, and his willingness to kind of call out referees or opposing coaches or his friends or any of that stuff. The reality is he's a pretty introverted, low-key kind of guy who knows when he needs to turn on the charm or knows when he needs to turn on the wit. And I think the Kiffin that you saw at SEC Media Days last week, when he's making jokes about Saban and making jokes about NIL and making jokes here and there, that's not the day-to-day that's not the day-to-day Kiffin you'll see in Oxford at every Monday press conference or every Wednesday press conference. He is more of a Saban acolyte now than people give him credit for. He's much more tame. He's much more willing to hold things close to the vest. As for Leach, it's kind of the same. He's not going to come out every single press conference and bluster about if a bear could beat a cougar in a fight. Most of the time, he's just going to be a guy who doesn't like to give an opening statement, wants to get right to the point, wants to get right to his questions, and he'll answer what's asked of him. Sometimes he'll get asked silly questions, and he'll answer the silly questions very sincerely. But I think for the most part, both of these guys are ball coaches first and foremost, and they're good at talking ball.
They definitely better be good at talking ball. Okay, let's talk about some ball with Leach. They started off fast. What was it, a win over LSU, if I can recall? Well, what happened there? What transformed? What happened? Why couldn't they carry that momentum, or were the schedule just tougher? Any explanation on how they can improve and be better this upcoming season in Mississippi State?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to spin this answer. One is, I mean, it was pretty clear that LSU did not have a solid game plan for how to stop the air raid. And if you look at, I think, the next 8 weeks after that game, or the next eight games after that game, Mississippi State averaged 14 points a game. Other defenses really figured out how you zone against the air raid, how you keep things underneath. If you look at average depth of target, their quarterback, Will Rogers, was throwing, I believe, 40 to 50% of his passes at or behind the line of scrimmage. It was just very much not a vertical offense, and defenses kind of sat back and let them come to them. The flip side of it is Mississippi State's leading passer last year was a true freshman. Mississippi State's leading rusher last year was a true freshman. Mississippi State's leading receiver last year was a true freshman. We're not talking about a learning curve of a team going from a Joe Moorhead offense to a team going to an air raid offense. We're talking about a team with a learning curve of playing high school football to playing college football. And that's why, if you look at the last two games of the season, a win over Missouri and then a bowl win over Tulsa, they won two in a row. Their offense seemed to be peaking forward. Their best passing game after that first week of the season was their third to last game of the year against Ole Miss. And we can talk about that Ole Miss and defense all we want, but they still had throw for more than 400 yards in that game. The offense did peak forward. So the question then becomes, is Mississippi State a team that is easy to scheme against, or is Mississippi State a team that learned from its own mistakes as the season went on? We don't have enough data yet to answer one way or the other, which is why this year is going to be pretty fun out in Starkville.
Anything huge with the NIL with either team as far as players getting some form of compensation off the field?
No, I think the biggest story in Mississippi with NIL is actually a player who has set his number too high, because Matt Corral, on the first day that NIL came out, Ole Miss's starting quarterback, I think he's got the eighth best Heisman odds or something right now, set his value at $10,000 for an hour for publicity time. And I talked to him about it twice. Now, he said, no, nobody's paid me $10,000 yet. I set the price deliberately too high because I knew it had to be worth my time. I didn't think that I wanted to waste time right now on speaking engagements, so I set the number at a number that I couldn't refuse. But he also kind of slyly, with a wink in his eye, said, but give it 3 months. It'll be too small of a value. So, I mean, he is betting on himself. He is thinking that if the season goes the way he thinks it will, and if he can stay in the Heisman talk, and if Ole Miss's offense can be as good this year as it was in last year, he might maybe get that. But with that storyline accepted, most of the NIL things that you've seen in Mississippi are the same things you've seen all across the country. A couple of Ole Miss players here and there hosting a youth camp, one player starting a clothing brand, a couple signing on with gaming companies to stream video games, that sort of thing, where it's your nickel and dime that is good for these players. If they got a chance to spread their brand, spread their image, and make a little bit of cash. But no, there is nobody in Mississippi who has attracted nearly $1 million like Nick Saban said about Bryce Young.
Well, with Nick Suss with Ole Miss beat writer at Clarion Ledger.
Nick, it's funny. I had written this question down to ask you because I've always said that there's only a handful of schools where I think you can play and win the Heisman. Like, remember Troy Davis from Iowa State? He rushed for 2,000 yards twice. I think he finished second once. He wasn't close the other time. The Lamar Jackson winning the Heisman at Louisville, to me, is one of the greatest sports stories that doesn't get nearly as much run as I think it deserves. He was so great that he won the Heisman. That's no shot at Louisville. It's just hard to win the Heisman. It schools outside of just a certain number of really biggies. I'm going to ask you, can Matt Corral legitimately win the Heisman?
That adverb is doing a lot of work there, because I think the only way Matt Corral can win the Heisman is if he does it extremely legitimately. I think the only way he can do it is if he's very clearly the best player in college football. But here's two things I'll say that are working against him, and then one thing that I'll say is very much working for him. First thing working against him, he was too good last year. I mean, if you go through every quarterback who has ever won the Heisman Trophy and look at it by yards per game, yards by pass attempt, touchdowns per game, touchdowns per pass attempt, those four metrics, only one Heisman-winning quarterback has ever been better than Corral was the year before the Heisman in even one of those categories, and that was Baker Mayfield. The year before a quarterback wins the Heisman, they're usually average to pretty good, or in the case of somebody like Lamar Jackson or Jameis Winston or Johnny Manziel, complete newcomers. It's really hard to win the Heisman when you are everybody knows who you are. The only exceptions in recent years quarterback-wise have been Baker Mayfield and Marcus Mariota. That said, another thing that might work against him, almost led the SEC in rushing yards per game last year, and that was with an All-America wide receiver who finished with more than 100 receiving yards per game. That guy's gone. All of the running backs and four out of the five offensive linemen are back. I think this Ole Miss team's going to run the ball a lot more than people think, and that's probably going to hurt Corral's Heisman candidacy. The thing that's working in Corral's favor, if anything, the SEC West is a jungle this year. Who knows who's the second or third best team? It seems like Alabama is the incumbent because they're Alabama and they've probably deserved it, but even this year's Alabama team has a lot of question marks. Ole Miss plays a very interesting non-conference schedule this year. They play Louisville to start the year in Atlanta. That'll be a fun non-conference game. They play Liberty midway through the season, which, who knows, Liberty could be 9-0 coming to Oxford for the Hugh Freeze reunion. And they play a full SEC West schedule plus Vanderbilt and Tennessee, which you'd think would be two winnable games in the East. So if you're looking at this team winning 9 or 10 games as a best case scenario in the SEC West, then you start to get your, well, RG3 was on a 9 or 10 win team in the Big 12, and Lamar Jackson was on a 9 or 10 win team in the ACC. That's when you start to get your sleeper candidacy.
Nick Suss joins us. They do have 7 starters back on defense. They got a bunch of seniors, I look like, on the depth chart. How much legitimately, there's that word again, how much better could this defense be than last year?
I mean, realistically, you have 10 starters back. They've only lost one player off their defense. The problem is the defense was bad. So it's always that problem that you have to weigh of, is it better to have a lot of starters back when your team was bad, or do you want the bad players to cycle through? So the thing that you have to look at with this Ole Miss defense is you're returning a bunch of players. You signed 13, I believe, defensive players in this signing class, and you have 2 players who had to sit out last year who are eligible now as transfers. You're going to have more depth than Ole Miss has had since the probation hit in 2016. And that's kind of been the issue with this Ole Miss defense the last 5 years. Hasn't so much been the top-level talent that's been missing. It's that last year when this team had a bout of positive COVID cases, they had to move 2 offensive players into the secondary to play Arkansas. It's that sort of thing where you don't have bodies, and that's hard to play defense in this modern era when teams are running a spread up tempo offense. Now they have those bodies. Now they went out and signed 7 DBs this offseason, and they went out and signed 5 defensive linemen. And they went out and did all of these things where you bring in a graduate transfer at linebacker, and you bring in a graduate transfer at safety, and you bring in a Georgia transfer who only got to play 2 games last year at safety. And with this reinvigoration of your defense, you hope that if you're an Ole Miss fan, you should be shooting for 70th. If you can improve your defense from 126th out of 130 to 70th out of 130, you're talking about a team that really possibly can contend for a New Year's Six Bowl if the offense is as good as it was last year. Now, of course, there's a lot of coin flips you have to win there. You lose Elijah Moore, you lose Royce Newman, you have a lot of question marks across your offense without that talent, but you could still possibly win some games if this defense can be mediocre.
Nick Suss with some good stuff from the Clarion Ledger, Ole Miss beat, joining us here on Blaine and Mickey.
No doubt, Nick. I just have one question left for you, and that is, we got to ask you, what are your thoughts on Texas and Oklahoma going to the SEC, and what kind of success or non-success, I guess, do you think they'll have as far as winning games early on if this does come to fruition?
Oh, I think that if you're talking about from an SEC vantage point, that's an unequivocal good thing. It's clearly good to have two of the biggest and most storied and most profitable programs in college football in your league. And one of the upshots that I don't think enough people are talking about is Texas won, the Capital One Cup this year for best athletic department in, or most successful rather, athletic department in college sports. I think they won 3 or 4 national championships across all sports. And Oklahoma is another team that always factors in with softball, always factors in with gymnastics. These are teams that could win the SEC another 2 or 3 national championships every year, not just talking about football. But then when you think about football and think about, well, is the end game of this Auburn and Alabama moving to the SEC East, or is the end game of this potting up into 4 divisions instead of 2 divisions, or is the end game of this going completely divisionless and kind of just trying to make it so you play 9 games every year against your conference? I think that's fun to imagine. I think that it truly does strike some questions about competitive balance for the playoff, and that's why I think that anyone who's expecting a very quick move on a 12-game playoff probably has to expect some delays if there's going to be a lot of conference realignment, and it looks like there's only going to be 4 major conferences instead of 5 now. But I think if you're just talking purely, is this good or is this bad, I think this helps everyone in the SEC, because even the bottom feeders of the SEC are going to get more revenue off of revenue sharing. Guys, I'm sorry, I might have to cut this short. I am at the doctor, so I will talk to you guys later. Thank you for the radio.
Yes, sir. Nick Suss, Clary Ledger, squeezing us in between doctor visits. You can't beat that. We had also mentioned this.
Appreciate it, Nick.
Thank you, Nick. He's long gone. We had also brought this up to him off air. We had mentioned he was the guy who had the exchange with Deion Sanders, and he said just not anything he's talking about in interviews or anything like that. He said it happened, and he's just gotten to moved on. So there you go. He was the guy who asked him a question, referred to him as Deion, and Deion said you wouldn't do that to Nick Saban, although I think somebody counted the number of times at SEC Media Days that somebody asked Nick Saban a question and led with Nick, and it was like 7 or 8 or 9 times, and of course he never said a word about it. But anyway, Nick was like, hey, man, we're just kind of leaving that in the past. So you do the interview with us. We respect your wishes. You don't want to talk about something. We don't talk about it. There is some rock and roll news out there that I don't want to talk about, but I'm about to have to share it next. There's some tough news from the rock and roll world that I will share. There's also some good news from the Titans receiver room world, according to their quarterback, Ryan Tannehill. We'll hear from the Titans quarterback and breaking news from the rock and roll world from some Hall of Famers after this. Blaine and Mickey, 104.5 The Zone. Whew. Man, this is a tough one. Blaine and Mickey, 104.5 The Zone. Getting ready to hand things off to 3HL, and this news coming down. ZZ Top bass player and singer, and of course a fantastic songwriter as well, Dusty Hill, has died at 72 years old. TMZ, it looks like, breaking the news. for a bunch of you rock and rollers out there and anybody who had MTV in the 80s and into the 90s, or anybody who just appreciated good rock and blues music, this was a band that resonated with you. And this guy was, again, there's only three of them. They've been making a lot of really good racket for 50 plus years now. So rest in peace, Dusty Hill, 72 years young.
Yeah.
And man, that's a tough one. As a bass player, he's an interesting guy, Blaine, because he could sing and he co-wrote great songs. They had all these hit songs in the 80s and all these Give Me All Your Lovin' and all this kind of stuff and Legs and like the songs that Sharp Dress Man, when people think of ZZ Top, they think of a bunch of those 80s songs, unless you were on the train with them in the 70s. They had some amazing stuff and they continue to put out good content. But those songs were essentially like a drum machine and keyboard bass. Like the drummer and the bass player, they might have helped write the songs or conceptualize the songs, but they didn't really even have big parts on them. They didn't show out on them, nothing like that. It was mainly the guitar player, Billy Gibbons, and he would go to Ardent Studios in Memphis, and he would make these great albums and would have different people sing on them. But it wasn't like this guy was like, no, I have to play bass and just kill it on all these songs. He didn't. He always did what was best for the song. And they have all these memorable songs. So he's a guy that I always looked up to, always put the song first, which you got to do. And that's a tough one for me, man. I've always been a big fan. Rest in peace, Dusty Hill. If you've owned a radio in 50 years, you've heard a bunch of ZZ Top songs.
Yeah, no question about it, man. Rest in peace, him and his family and crew and everybody surrounding him, you know, and support. But did we know that he was there something wrong, or did he just pass away out of nowhere?
Haven't had a chance to read because this is all breaking. I know they're still making music, and I had seen something about them touring and playing shows, so I would have to look and read and see if it was maybe he was starting to battle an illness and it had gotten the best of him. I don't know. I mean, he was 72, and you know, the older you get, the younger that all these numbers seem to you. So I'll have to do some research into it. But
the article says he died peacefully in his sleep, with no other real details on you know, potential cause of death.
Oh, well, okay.
So yeah. I don't know that it was anything sudden. I'm not sure. But talk about a blend of rock and blues. Those guys are like on the Mount Rushmore of blues slash rock. And Mickey, I was telling you this, Blaine, too, the Netflix documentary on those guys, I think is called Little Old Band from Texas. So good. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. And some of their new stuff is really good, too.
Oh, okay. Well, Billy Gibbons, one of those guys whose tone just speaks for itself guitar wise and still out there just killing it with his tone. And that Don used to make fun of me when I talk about guitar tones. But anyway, guitar tone is important to musicians and he sounds great. And Dusty, a huge part of the band for all those years. So rest in peace. And as Blaine said, to all his family and his friends and all those fans who are just reeling from this, you know, thoughts, prayers, thinking about you guys. Titans are back in camp. We've talked a lot of football today. We had to sneak in a little rock and roll news, but Titans receiver room is special. You got a free agent with Reynolds. You got the guy you'd always been trying to draft in A.J. Brown. You've been looking for since D. Mason, Drew Bennett. Then, oh, by the way, you sign a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer in Julio Jones. Ryan Tannehill, the quarterback, spoke today, Blaine, about having a stacked wide receiver room, and he does.
They're competing. You know, it's a stacked receiver room. There's no doubt about it. It's going to be a big competition throughout this training camp is to see who comes out of there. You know, I think that's a nod to John Robinson and Vrabel for being able to put that room together and that competition together in that room. Obviously, big, strong, tough, physical group. So excited to have that competition in that room, and those guys will be able to help us throughout the year.
I know you're fired up about the offense. I said this in the last segment. I know you think this could be the best offense the Titans have ever had. Mm-hmm. And then we talked a lot about last year. Boy, if the defense could get to the middle of the pack, this team could be dangerous. Well, they spend enough resources to get to the middle of the pack or even better, and they certainly have the resources on offense. I don't ever want to have too many expectations or too much, but I do have expectations for this offense to go and be prolific this year.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how they handle that pressure, and will it be a little bit easier because the defense kind of facilitates and plays a lot better. So we'll see, because early in the season, you don't know where Bud Dupree and Caleb Farley's going to be, as far as will they even be on the field, let's say that, and then they have to gradually ease themselves back into game shape and get into shape and get the chemistry with your teammates, or will they be gradually at the end of the preseason starting to get into, you know, shape and form and been hitting the book, you know, mentally and out there having dialogue, doing walkthroughs. That way you can speed up the process as though you were playing, because what you do is you trick your mind and do all the mental reps, and he doesn't know that you're not running, you know, so you can do every rep like you out there. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly the defense can come together as a unit with the chemistry and communication piece and everything else. But it's going to be a lot of expectation. I think the expectation, like always, is always Super Bowl or bust. But I think it's hype now. Now that we've seen what this offense could do with the change of coordinators, you can say you have all the pieces. But one thing that happens sometimes with coaches, they want to put their stamp on what they like to do. That's not to say they're not going to do what they're going to do, because they're definitely going to run King Henry. They're still going to do those things. They're going to do some of the things they did last year, maybe even the majority. But he's going to do something different than the previous coordinator. I guarantee it. And it could be just something as simple as, you know, guys are interchangeable and they play outside and inside, you know.
Yep.
You just never know. Maybe see more Brown in the slot because they like the matchups, and then Reynolds outside more, you know, or vice versa with Julio. You never know. So I'm just interested to see where they go. But, man, the sky's the limit with this team. That's why I asked JG, John Glennon, you know, is this the best roster in Titans history on paper? And I didn't ask if it was the best team. We all know who's the best team.
Well, only one's gotten to the last game of the year, and you were on it, that's for sure. We'll keep this discussion going tomorrow. We'll take your calls. You can join the discussion anytime on the Mark Spain Real Estate Hotline. Right now, though, time for us to get out of here. Time for 3HL. Hey, have a great night, everybody. Maybe listen to a little ZZ Top tonight and send up a prayer for our guy, Brother Dusty. Going to miss him.
As always, happy hump day. Peace.